Ladies and gentlemen, NBC's worldwide coverage of the news tonight has included reports and commentary from H.B. Kaltenborn, David Anderson in London, Wright Bryan, on-the-spot report overseas, Robertson John from New York, John W. Vandercook from overseas, and Morgan Beatty and Richard Harkness from Washington. And now we continue NBC's worldwide coverage with a report from Robertson John in New York.
Here's a bulletin from an advanced fighter base in England. It says, the beaches of northern France are alive right now with Allied troops. Allied troops landing in wave after wave. That's the story brought back by fighter pilots returning from the French invasion coast. The landings were carried out under the red glare and the black smoke of Allied and German guns exchanging fire across the Channel waters. Here's a bulletin from London. The military correspondent of the British Reuters agency reports that Adolf Hitler himself is taking personal command of all German anti-invasion operations. Hitler is said to be surrounded by his staff, which includes four Nazi field marshals, and he's believed to have moved his headquarters to some place in northern France. The German radio has just warned Holland to expect invasion. Berlin says to Holland, the hour has struck. The Nazis told the Dutch, we don't know where the next blow may fall, so prepare yourselves for all eventualities. Berlin radio, monitored by NBC, has broadcast that strong Allied air attacks have been launched on the Dieppe area. DNB, that's a German news agency, claims that big Allied warships have been set on fire by German guns in the Seine estuary. There is no confirmation from our side of that report. And now here's a bulletin from London that says the first Allied paratroopers to land in German-occupied France today met only scattered small arms fire from the fields. And one of the latest German broadcasts describes a constant flow of Allied reinforcements to the beachheads. Berlin is constantly emphasizing the power and ferocity of the Allied air attack and the Allied ground attack. The Germans admit that some of their key airfields have already been wiped out, although the invasion is only a few hours old. Other air bases, they say, have been badly mauled. Reports to Allied headquarters say that American Mitchell and British Mosquito bombers are smashing bridges and railroads, that they're wrecking highways, that they're cutting junction points in order to hinder the German concentration of troops at danger spots. A Dutch, Polish, and Australian, as well as American, Canadian, and British squadrons are taking part in the great Allied aerial attack. The pilots report little movement on the roads and very few Nazi planes in the sky. The Germans have admitted already that the Allies are succeeding to some extent. A DNB broadcast said the German defense forces, which were deceived by the dropping of paratroop dummies, are engaged in fighting with enemy airborne troops and have made numerous British and American prisoners. Well, of course, the Germans would say that. There's no confirmation of it. Here's another bulletin which says the bulk of the naval forces in the invasion operation were provided by the British and American navies, with about three British ships to two American ships. All other Allied nations provided their quota of the invasion vessels. American Thunderbolt pilots returning from the invasion front today reported they met no enemy aircraft, although they did encounter considerable flak as they provided protective cover for the amphibious troops. All the Thunderbolts returned safely to England. Right now, a shattering barrage, such as reduced the defenders of the Mediterranean island of Pantelleria last summer, such a barrage as that, only much, much greater, is being laid down by the combined air forces. Added to this tremendous barrage is the thunder from warships. The American Coast Guard is over there manning landing craft and transports and rescue ships. In the landing craft are men who know the beaches on which they are to land like they know the backs of their hands. For months, in English camps, they drilled down to the finest detail for their job. They'd formed into combat teams, some of those teams a dozen men, some of them several thousand. One source at Allied headquarters said he believed that little help can be expected at the start from the inhabitants of invaded areas because all able-bodied persons have been evacuated by the enemy. Only women, children, the aged, and the infirm were left behind. They were left behind deliberately by the Germans as potential hindrances to Allied operations. As the day progressed, DNB broadcast frequent claims of progress. Four Allied parachute and airborne divisions are taking part in the invasion, so the Nazis say. And one force of paratroopers, which landed in the Seine estuary, according to Berlin, has been wiped out. But we can't believe that yet.
And now, for further reports on the Allied invasion of Europe, we take you to the nation's capital, to Richard Harkness in the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning. Well, when we think of this attack on Hitler's Fortress Europe today, we think of it as being purely military. But the fact is that behind this invasion news is a long period of diplomatic maneuvering, a long period of diplomatic pulling and tugging. Well, these diplomatic operations date back almost to the day of Pearl Harbor. Since that time, the Russians in general, Stalin in particular, have been applying every kind of pressure to persuade the Americans and the British to open a real second front on the continent of Europe. And President Roosevelt and General George C. Marshall, our chief of staff, were generally sympathetic to Marshal Stalin's demand. But Prime Minister Churchill, hard-headed, cautious, held off. And now that the invasion has come, the Russians might very well be firing off one of those big artillery salutes of theirs in Moscow. And only history can tell whether Mr. Churchill was a hard-headed military realist or whether by holding off, whether the Prime Minister was overly cautious. Instead of throwing our strength across the British Channel in early 1942, as Stalin wanted, Churchill mapped instead our invasion of North Africa. Stalin called for his second front in Western Europe again in 1943. Instead, we invaded Italy that spring. Well, during this period, Premier Stalin refused even to meet with the President and Mr. Churchill. Stalin's one price for a meeting was a statement, a guarantee, really, of when America and Great Britain would open this real second front. Well, Stalin received this guarantee, even the approximate date, at Tehran. And now our invasion of Europe is climaxing one of the most amazing diplomatic chapters of world history. Well, this bit of pre-invasion history goes back to May 1942, right here in Washington, our capital. The president received V.M. Molotov, the personal spokesman for Marshal Stalin. This meeting was kept secret. But after Molotov returned to Moscow, the White House issued a formal statement on the conversation. And here in a nutshell is the important part of that statement. In the course of these conversations, full understanding was reached with regard to the urgent task of creating a second front in Europe in 1942. That statement, of course, was couched in broad language. But all newsmen in Washington knew that Molotov went back to Moscow firmly convinced that Russia's allies would invade Western Europe and firmly convinced, too, that the invasion would come before January 1st, 1943. Now, that recall was in May of 1942. A month later, in June, Mr. Churchill followed Molotov to Washington to see President Roosevelt. While Molotov had argued eloquently and persuasively for a second front in 1942, the British Prime Minister was equally forceful on the other side of the question. Well, Mr. Churchill lowered his head like a bull, to put it figuratively, and bluntly asserted that there would be no second front in Western Europe in 1942. The Prime Minister said that any invasion at that time would be for what he called strictly political reasons, for the purpose of placating Russia, and the Prime Minister said that the British weren't having any, thank you. Well, as history looks back on Mr. Churchill's visit here, it must accord him a great deal of logic. To Brookfell, even while the Prime Minister talked at the White House, and Marshal Rommel led his Axis army across the border clear into Egypt. So Stalin had to be told that there would be no invasion of Western Europe in 1942. Well, it still is not a matter of public record. We'll have to wait until the war is over. But Stalin's reply must have been as fiery as Russian vodka. For almost immediately after, in July, that was less than a month after Mr. Churchill went back home, Mr. Roosevelt sent a distinguished mission to London. In a special plane were General Marshall, our top-ranking military officer, Admiral Ernest J. King, our top-ranking naval officer, Mr. Harry L. Hopkins, the president's closest friend and advisor, and, making up the party, Mr. Stephen T. Early, the president's press secretary. Well, as the story was told later, General Marshall and Admiral King tried to talk Mr. Churchill into changing his mind about a second front, but Churchill still said no. As an alternative, the American delegation proposed our invasion of Africa. The British accepted the proposition, and Mr. Roosevelt set out to explain the situation to the Russians. The president promised this, that action would be taken to divert German strength from the attack on Russia. Then, to carry on this diplomatic sugaring of Premier Stalin, Winston Churchill went to Moscow in person to try to make the Russian leader see why the invasion was delayed. But Stalin, obviously, was not appeased. His reply was blunt. The United States and Great Britain, he said, should make good on that promise given Molotov in Washington. We should invade fully, and, he said, we should invade on time. But instead, we went ahead and invaded North Africa, what the Prime Minister called then the soft underbelly of the Axis, on the night of November 7th, a Saturday of 1942. Well, by this time, Stalin was finally convinced that there would be no invasion of Western Europe in 1942. So, grudgingly, he did acknowledge the Anglo-American drive against the Axis, against Marshal Rommel, and his Africa Corps. And grudgingly, it seemed, Stalin told the world that our African operation fulfilled the perquisites for undertaking a second front. But when the president met with Churchill at Casablanca, Stalin stayed in Russia. Now, he was cordially invited, but he messaged our two war leaders that he was too busy fighting the Nazis. And then, shortly after Casablanca, Stalin threw a new diplomatic bombshell into the Anglo-American camp. In a special order of the day, a special order celebrating the anniversary of the Red Army, Stalin said this on February 23rd, 1943. I quote the head of the Russian government. In view of the absence of a second front in Europe, the Red Army alone is bearing the whole weight of the war. Well, Mr. Roosevelt and the Prime Minister held another meeting in May of last year, back in Washington this time. Our two leaders decided that they must see Stalin. So, a little later, the President sent Joseph E. Davies, the former ambassador to Moscow, on another mission to Moscow. Well, Davies' trip, as we learned later, was for only one purpose. And the purpose was this, to invite Stalin to meet with our Anglo-American commanders-in-chief and to get a definite answer to bring back to the White House. Well, Stalin replied, apparently, that he was agreeable to a meeting at this time, a session which he said should be held a little later in the summer, last summer. Well, a march of events made it necessary for Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Churchill to meet again in August of 1943. They waited until the last minute before setting this meeting, hoping to hear from Stalin exactly where and when he would make the conference a Big Three meeting instead of a Big Two. But when no word came from Moscow, the President and the Prime Minister held their own session at Quebec. Well, I covered this session at Quebec for the National Broadcasting Company, and standing there as the President and Mr. Churchill held their final press and radio conference, I saw how they emphasized their wish that Stalin might have made the party a threesome, and how fervently they hoped that Stalin would join them later on. But Stalin did not join them, and as we know now, his price was still, when will you invade Western Europe? And obviously, our president and the Prime Minister of Great Britain were not yet ready to tell him
at least not in advance of Quebec. When finally we proposed this plan, Anthony Eden, the British Foreign Secretary, flew to Moscow and set the stage for a meeting of foreign ministers. That is, Secretary of State Cordell Hull for the United States, Mr. Eden for Great Britain, and Foreign Commissar Molotov, the same man who had come to Washington to get a second front for the Russians. Well, now, this session was to be held in Moscow, and it took place, all right, in October of 1943. And
then, after the declaration of Moscow, which was hailed throughout the United Nations world as a great success, Stalin did agree to meet President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill. Well, our two leaders held a preliminary talk in Cairo. They conferred there with the Chinese Generalissimo, Chiang Kai-shek. And then, in flying in separate planes to confuse the Germans, they went on to Tehran, where at last they met Stalin. Well, there, as we know now, the President and Mr. Churchill promised Stalin a second front in Western Europe. And they named the date, the spring of 1944. The date now burns so indelibly in Anglo-American military history. Not only that, in explaining why we had waited so long, Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Churchill promised that when the invasion date arrived, it would be the mightiest amphibious assault the world has ever seen. And obviously, from the news reports which have been coming into the NBC newsroom here in Washington all night, this is the mightiest amphibious assault the world has ever seen. And Stalin agreed to this plan, but with the manner of a man wanting to make absolutely certain, Stalin wanted to know the name of the man who would lead the invasion. Well, a man's name was sent to Mr. Stalin 3 days later. The leader of these combined Anglo-American forces was to be General Dwight D. Eisenhower. And Stalin accepted. And showing how well satisfied he was with the selection of Eisenhower, he conferred upon General Ike one of the highest awards of the Russian government. The only award, incidentally, which Stalin himself has accepted in this World War II. So that is the diplomatic history behind the invasion of Europe. But with the closing of that book, the Allies and Russia began a new diplomatic game. The diplomatic game looking toward the peace that will follow our invasion success. Our invasion of Western Europe, just revealed this evening, has settled a big diplomatic issue between the three top-ranking United Nations. But still, as peace draws nearer, there is no clear light ahead on three other knotty diplomatic problems. There is still no agreement, at least no public agreement, on how we will handle post-war Germany. Now, Stalin has his Free German Committee, which could mean that Stalin intends to dominate Germany by pulling the strings while the puppet German leaders dance. However, we have heard very little of the Stalin Free German Committee recently, and so there probably will be Russian cooperation with Great Britain and the United States on post-war Germany. Another problem, Stalin recognized the government of the one-time fascist Badoglio in Italy. And so far, we in the British have withheld that full recognition. However, that point has become largely academic, what with the liberation of Rome and the stepping aside of King Victor Emmanuel. Well, Great Britain went into this war to make good on her pledges to Poland. But still, Russia is calling the tune in Poland. And now that the invasion is on, those diplomatic problems come even more to the front. So there is the diplomatic background to this mighty invasion effort, which was formally announced at 3:32 this morning, Eastern Wartime. Stalin has been applying every bit of diplomatic pressure he could to force this second front. He has been applying this pressure ever since May 1942, when President Roosevelt virtually promised a second front in Western Europe. We, that is, Mr. Roosevelt, the Chief of Staff General Marshall, were willing to try this cross-channel invasion long before this. But Prime Minister Churchill held off. Instead of Europe, we invaded North Africa in the fall of 1942. We drove across the Mediterranean to Italy in 1943. But at Tehran, Stalin drew a definite promise from the president and Mr. Churchill, a promise being carried out this morning on the beaches of once-conquered France.